One thing I've learned after all these years, you're gonna save yourself a whole lot of tears. Don't try to figure out who was wrong and who was right. Got to move along, baby. Go with the flow.
Yeah, you gotta roll with the punches. Hi, everybody. Your old friend Mike Houlihan. Welcome back to Hibernian Radio. Brought to you by McCann's Irish Oatmeal, Mike Haggerty, Buick, GMC, Volkswagen, and personally injury attorney Carol Ann Gallagher. So great to be back here with Lizzie McNeil's tonight. And don't forget, every Wednesday night we're here on 6 o'clock. You'll have a blast. Come on by. And, we're into the winter. What can I tell you? The doldrums of winter. But we're going to relieve all that because we have a terrific guest tonight. And this is also part of our new focus on Irish first responders, cops, firefighters, paramedics, because they represent the everyday equivalent of our mythological Irish warriors. And we got one tonight who is an old friend, worked with us for years on the Skinny and Hooley show as our history detective. I want to welcome back to the show our old pal Rick Barrett.
Hey, Hooley, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh,
I love
pleasure.
Being here.
Oh,
I love
you're,
it.
You're the best.
It's like we're getting the band back together.
Exactly. did you see that ad, by the way?
I did. I loved it.
Oh, good. Well, you can join us. And I'll mention that Skinny and I are going back to Ireland in July.
He told me that today.
Yeah, and we're getting the band back together, so look for the ad in the Irish American News
okey-doke.
In February. Now, let me give you a little background on our pal, Richard Barrett. He's a retired DEA agent. Grew up on the south side of Chicago, went to Brother Rice.
Oh, yeah.
You started your career as an IRS agent investigating mobsters who didn't pay their taxes.
Yeah.
That could be a little dicey, I would think.
It was fun. It was a fluke. I was a student at UIC. And
yeah.
One day my buddy comes in and goes, hey, they're doing interviews for possible internships at the IRS. It used to be called the Intelligence Division, now called the Criminal Investigations Division.
Yeah.
But they're the ones who do, you know, federal violations of tax law. That's how they got Al Capone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I really wasn't interested, but my pal, Rich Lucas, another Southsider,
yeah.
he said, come on, you got nothing to lose, let's try. So we tried it.
What year was this?
It was 1974.
Okay.
And lo and behold, we both were accepted. And we had to go to school in the morning and then take a train downtown and work in an internship for 16 months.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. But the guarantee was that, hey, if you can get through this program, keep your grades up, stay out of trouble, we're going to make you an agent as soon as you graduate.
An IRS agent.
IRS special agent, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Carry a badge, carry a gun, the whole thing.
Wow. And you came from a cop family.
Yeah, I came from a cop family through generations of
Irish
police officers.
Yeah.
So it was pretty fun. I was the one that broke the tradition of going on the Chicago PD. You know, because
the only
this internship, and it led to a federal badge, and that led to
a little more security, probably.
Yeah, you know, my dad never wanted to be on the police department anyway. He told me that from the time I could walk.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always pretty... But I did sneak down and take the test in 1975.
Did you really? Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. He did not like that at all.
Oh.
I don't know if I ever told you
that. I took the test when I was 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I placed number 11.
Did you really?
That scared me right away. I went, if I'm the 11th smartest guy who's taking this test, something ain't right. And then the day I was supposed to go and start at the... academy. I had a hangover. I was a hippie by then.
Oh, yeah, you were a hippie.
And my old man yanked me out of bed. Get the heck down there. What's wrong with you? And I walked in an hour and a half late. I had long hair. And they yanked me out and made an example of me all day. And I went, this sucks. And I went home and said, you know, I think I'm going to become an actor. And my old man went, John Wilkes Booth was a GD actor. What are you, nuts? And the rest is history.
Oh, that's funny.
Now, how did you move from the IRS to the DEA?
I was, you know what? I had an accounting background because of IRS.
Ah, yeah.
And DEA said, hey, we're going to start a third prong to our investigative strategy. And that is our in addition to seasoned dope and arresting people, we're going to try and take away their assets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they said, we need some guys who can follow the money, some guys with accounting backgrounds, and there I was. So I applied, and I got in, hired in Chicago in 78.
You joined the DEA in 78. Yeah.
Yeah, in Chicago, right here. It was great. But then, you know.
Now, did you have to go to Quantico or anything like that?
Back in the day, our academy was right at DEA headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this was prior to Quantico.
Oh, okay.
So we went to this old building, and it had a classroom on the fourth floor, and they called that the National Training Institute.
Yeah.
We went to a little gym, and they just pounded the hell out of us. It was pretty cool. But I was young. I was 25.
Sure.
And I loved it. You know, yeah. Oh, great. Let's do more sit-ups. Let's do push-ups.
Yeah. All You're still stuff. Like that.
I loved it. I have to say I liked it, you know, because I was single, and the world was going to be mine, right?
Yeah. And then you went or transferred to Paris.
Well, actually, I went to Denver first. What a lucky guy I was. Yeah. Did 6 years in Denver.
Wow.
Yeah, DEA, Denver Police Task Force, and it was an absolute ball.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe I was getting paid for
it. What years were that?
February 79 until January of 85.
Oh, wow.
6 years.
Yeah.
And the Denver cops are just the best. They were so funny.
Yeah.
And they were way ahead of the game. They were doing wires before Illinois even had a wiretap statute.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It was really great. We used to go up to the mountains and buy dope and Steamboat and Aspen and Vail.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. I mean, when you're 25 years old and you're running the streets with gung-ho police.
Now, were you doing undercover?
Oh, yeah. I was buying all kinds of drugs.
Did you have, like, a beard or anything like
that? Yeah, I had a beard.
Disguise and all that? Yeah.
But, you know, it's money that buys dope, and you just got to be able to talk the talk. And
Yeah.
And the police taught me the job. I mean, you know,
yeah.
They called me Baby Fed. I was a Baby Fed.
Oh, okay.
Baby Fed, you can ride
the
with
Colorado
us today.
The Colorado cops called you Baby Fed.
Yeah, Baby Fed, you can ride with us today.
Yeah.
Baby Fed, we're going to have you go to Five Points in Denver and buy some heroin on a street corner.
Holy cow.
You ready for that? I said, yeah. I'm ready.
Good for you.
But it was great. I love those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I put in for Paris on a lark, just on a complete lark. I mean, my wife was pregnant with our second.
Yeah.
And we had just bought a brand new house. Didn't even have a lawn yet.
Where was it?
It was in right where the Columbine. It was right near Columbine, about 2 miles away.
Columbine?
Yeah.
In Colorado?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
We just bought a new house there. And I put in for this job in Paris. Never thought in a zillion years I'd get it. And lo and behold, I got it.
Yeah.
I came on. I said, Patty, we're going to Paris. What?
Did you speak any French?
No, pas du tout. I didn't. They sent me to language school.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really challenging. I mean, believe it or not, when you're one-on-one with a French teacher who only speaks French,
yeah,
it was tough.
You better get it.
Yeah, it was, you know.
And you were just married. You had a young family.
Yeah.
How many kids did you have then?
Well, what happened was Michael was born at Christmas
of
84, and then we got on a plane 30 days later and flew to Paris.
Holy cow.
She always reminds me, I hadn't even had my 6-week checkup yet.
Oh, wow.
Well, we got on the plane with a 7-pound baby, and half the people on the plane were French.
Oh,
you know, they were going home.
Yeah.
They were in the States for Christmas or whatever, on vacation. So they gave us that French stare, you know, and turned our nose up like, look at those Americans going on vacation with a tiny little infant. And I was like, no, we're actually moving there. And they're like, oh, wow, why didn't you say so? Sit down.
And so you moved right to Paris.
Yes,
did
we did.
Did you get an apartment there?
We were in temporary housing for 90 days. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And then we found the most beautiful apartment ever. It's probably the best 3 years of our life.
Yeah.
It was gorgeous. If you know Paris, you know they're divided into little neighborhoods called arrondissements.
Yeah.
And we lived in the 7th, which is, honest to God, 2 blocks from the Eiffel Tower we lived.
Wow.
Beautiful Hausmannian apartment. This guy Hausmann, he was the architect that built most of the apartment buildings in that neighborhood. 1898. It was old. It was classic. It was gigantic. Wood floors. Real nice. Right by the American College of Paris. Now it's the university. It's a university, but then it was a college.
American
college.
You doing drug work?
Yeah. Now? Oh, yeah. Yeah. We worked with the French police.
Oh.
Every day,
oh,
and
man.
That was exciting. I mean, I thought I knew French until I walked in
the
French police station. I was like, huh? What are these guys talking about? And it was just billows of smoke, old building.
Everybody's smoking.
Oh, my God. Yeah. 6 guys in a room, typewriters, smoking. And it was crazy. But they liked us. You know, they liked Americans.
Yeah. Then.
Yeah. Despite what people thought, you know. And all you'd have to do is walk in that police station with a cowboy hat on and cowboy boots, and they would go completely crazy. Jean Wayne.
Oh, yeah.
Le cowboy. They love American Westerns, you know.
And then when was your next child born?
Mary Caitlin, she was born when we got back to Chicago.
Oh, okay. So it was just you and your
young. And two boys.
Two boys in Paris.
Yeah. The oldest went to French kindergarten, which worked out extremely well for him later. I mean, fast forward, he goes to Northwestern on a naval scholarship, and he goes in the Navy, and he's an officer, and he goes in the Persian Gulf when he was deployed, and they're working, believe it or not.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah, with the French. With the two French ships were part of their, you know.
You know, I always wanted to write a dirty French novel called French Kindergarten. Sorry.
Yeah. He was the only American in the class. It was pretty cool. He spoke French like a French person.
Did he really?
But anyway, the point is, when he was deployed years later, they were working in conjunction with the French, and the French were trying to send a teletype over to them, and it was in really, really poor English.
Yeah.
So Tim just wrote back in French and said, "Would you rather parler français?" And then we're like, oui, there's an American officer aboard who speaks French. Oh, my God. So they got invited to the French ship. They flew a helicopter over to the USS Wasp, landed on the deck, picked up a whole, like, five or six officers, to include the Commodore. They flew them over to the French ship called the Dauphine, spent the entire day there.
Oh, this is your son.
This is my son. Yeah, it was pretty cool. The reason I'm telling it is because they wanted to keep him on board for 90 days, and the American captain said no.
Oh, yeah.
No. But it was cool. They returned with French wine and freshly cooked baguettes. That was pretty cool. Yeah. So, yeah, living in France when they were at a young age was good for them. 3.
And that's when you got involved with the French Connection,
too. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, you know what? I was a laborer, really. I was part of a team, and my boss was a brilliant guy from New York. And he had these really high-powered Lebanese and, you know, cooperators.
Yeah.
You know? And they had...
Sources, basically,
who could supply morphine base. That's how you make heroin. And... we had to finesse and work with the French. You know, they had work under the Napoleonic Code and undercover work and controlled deliveries are everyday occurrences in the United States. But over in France, it's défendu. It's prohibited by the Napoleonic Code. So we had to work with the French judge and work around it a little bit. And anyway, long story short, we brought in morphine base from Syria, from Damascus.
Yeah.
And we did.
That's where they were making it.
Yeah, that's where they you know, it comes from the opium comes from a poppy, and they grow it in Afghanistan, and they refine it, and they get morphine base from the opium, 10-to-1 conversion, and then opium.
10-to-1? Oh, so they cut it.
Basically. No. You mean you need, let's say you need 10 kilos of opium to make 1 kilo of morphine base.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, to transform it. And then morphine base transforms to heroin, 1.1-to-1. So it's, you know, almost... almost 1-to-1. So in any event, long story longer, we, it's kind of a funny story, we thought that we'd make this controlled delivery to guys we were convinced were fugitives from the original French Connection. And the French were doubtful about that, you know. Oh, les Américains sont fous, we're fools, you know.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I had pictures of these guys from a prior surveillance, and I go, "Do you know this guy?" And they almost dropped their eye teeth.
It was the guy.
It was a guy named Francois Scapula and his buddy named Charles Altieri. And they were both chemists in the original French Connection in Marseille. They're both from Marseille.
Yeah.
And they flew to Coupe, and they became fugitives, and they were gone for all those years. Yeah. So where'd they go? They went to Lebanon, where they cooked, and they went to... Thailand, where they cooked, and they were in India for a long time, where they...
So they're just making the stuff.
They're making the stuff. They never stopped. They just, you know, went to 3 different countries, and they were making for 12 years. And then they had this great plan to build a permanent laboratory in the mountains in Switzerland. And they had, you know, a deal with one of the organized crime families in New York. They were the cooks. And we happened to get lucky, and we delivered...
Well, kind of like the movie French Connection.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was just like it, except that we, you know, In that, they seized heroin in New York when it came into the United States.
Yeah.
We actually were a little bit different. We seized the laboratory in a foreign country, in Switzerland, and three fugitives from the French Connection. The third guy's name was Viscreel, Philippe Viscreel. And we pinched all three of them, and, man, it was pretty cool. I mean, the Attorney General of the United States was Edward Meese at the time.
Ed Meese.
I love Meese to pieces. He got on a plane 2 days later with the administrator of DEA and came over to shake hands with the boys. Because we had an international team, French police, Swiss police, and Les Americains from the DEA. There were two of us. And it was just a great time. You know,
ever think about writing about this?
Actually, you know what? The story made the cover of Newsweek magazine.
Yeah.
The Return of the French Connection. How drug agents broke up the heroin deal of the decade. It was really exciting. The French loved it. And, you know, two great things came out of it. Because two of the three guys that we pinched cooperated.
Oh, yeah, they flipped.
They flipped because they did not want to go back to France where a long sentence was waiting them.
Yeah.
And, you know, make it real short, but they pointed to the guy who murdered the judge who oversaw and presided over the original French Connection cases.
Oh, wow.
He was murdered. His name was Jean-Pierre Michel. He was murdered, and it was unsolved. He was blown off, he was in his car at a red light, and a motorcycle pulled up, and the guy in the back
of
the motorcycle. Yeah, in Marseille, and assassinated him right there at the intersection. It was in October of 1985. May of 1985, and then in October, the fall, I'm so sorry, in May of 81, he was murdered, and it went unsolved till 85 when these guys flipped. Yeah, sorry. And so for 4 years, you know, who killed the judge? And lo and behold, we grabbed these
guys.
We got lucky. We didn't know that he was involved in the murder of the judge, but that's what he gave up. And they had a trial in France, and the guy was convicted of the murder of Judge Michel. They made a movie about it. The French made a movie. And you can see it on Netflix.
Do they have capital punishment in France?
You know,
they didn't take him out and hang him or
anything? No. But that's, you know, it was pretty cool. And then
the other guy
rolled over, and he admitted that he was the chemist for a New York crime family, and the case was prosecuted in the Southern District of New York, and a bunch of guys went to prison for life.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they sold. They made and sent to New York City 240 kilos of French heroin, which was sold on the street. I'm sure it killed a lot of people.
Oh, wow.
And this organized crime family was instrumental in its distribution and importation, manufacture, and distribution. And they all went to jail.
What organized crime family? Was it the Columbos?
It was the Gambino.
Oh,
family.
The Gambinos, yeah.
Yeah, but not Gambino himself, a cell of it, if you would, in today's mantra, a cell. Yeah, they were called the family was the Di Benedentos.
Uh-huh.
And that's what the Newsweek article is all about. Anyway, it was pretty cool. And then I came back from France to go home to Chicago.
Yeah.
I was really excited.
Now,
about
you
that.
Were telling me you just got an invitation to the French Connection reunion.
Yes, they're having the 50th reunion of the original French Connection in Marseille.
Yeah.
In June.
And you're going, you think.
They invited every DEA agent who ever worked in France from 1970 until present. And, of course, I was there in 85, 86, 87.
You think DEA will pay for your way over
no,
there?
No, absolutely
okay.
not.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
No.
And you were telling me the actor who played Popeye Doyle might be there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What's his name? Carl Malden, right?
No.
No. Oh, you're right. He's dead. He's
Gene
dead.
Gene Hackman.
Excuse me. I get mixed up on my actors. That'd be quite a thing if Malden showed up.
He played Popeye Doyle. Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman played Popeye.
I watched that on the plane coming back from Ireland. Mm. I watched just for you. I thought, hey, Ricky,
that's pretty cool.
It's a great movie.
Well, you can watch the one about
Roy Scheider and Friedkin directed it.
That was a great movie.
Yeah.
God, I was in high school when that came out. I was in high school.
You never thought when you saw it that you'd be involved someday, huh?
I think I spent more time looking at the girl next to me than the screen. But
what do you mean? In high school, that would be Brother Rice. They didn't have girls then, did they?
I think Mother McCauley was right next door.
Of course,
come on.
Yeah.
Kidding me?
Okay, so you came back to Chicago in 85?
88. I came back just the beginning of 1988.
And then you got involved with the investigation of Larry Hoover.
I did. It was fun.
And all about the gangster disciples.
Gangster disciples. You know what? They promoted me to a group supervisor, which is like being a sergeant on the PD. It's a first line supervisor.
Yeah.
And my bosses said, hey, we're going to take your group and we're going to make it a gang task force.
Yeah.
So I had 23 guys in the group, a lot of CPD guys and gals, Cook County Sheriff's Police, and, you know, all over, hodgepodge of agencies.
Sure.
And you know what? We said, we're going to go after the leaders of these criminal organizations called Gangster Disciples, Black Disciples, Latin Kings. We're going to target the leaders. And we're going to, you know, because they're like corporate structured, like a pyramid, with Larry Hoover, in this case of the GDs, was the CEO at the top, even though he was incarcerated.
I know. He was in jail for like 20 years.
Yeah, for murder.
But operating. You know, we're going to take a break now because I want to get into that story when we return.
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break here on Hibernian Radio and be right back after these messages from our friends.
There's no friend like an old friend. Southside Cousins Mike and Dick Haggerty have been selling cars for over 45 years. They've been in business together since 1982, when they started their first store, where everybody in the old neighborhood bought their cars. I go way back with the Haggertys. Mike's a Mount Carmel alum and Dick is St. Ignatius. Dick and Mike have been particularly classy to me over the years. Whenever I visit their showroom, it's old school. Buick GMC at 9301 South Cicero, or the Volkswagen store at 89th and Cicero, both in Oak Lawn. So do yourself a favor. Get to know the Haggerty family. You'll be delighted you did. I'm currently driving a used car I bought at Haggerty's. It's a gem. And when I think I got lucky, I have to tell myself, no, it's because Haggerty took good care of me. God bless him. Call him today at 708-423-5000, 708-423-5000, or go to HaggertyCars.com. Generations of Southside Irish have been happily driving Haggerty cars for generations. Visit Mike Haggerty Buick and GMC at 93rd and Cicero, and Mike Haggerty Volkswagen at 89th and Cicero. And tell them Hooley sent you. And if you're a first responder, you just might get a better deal than I did.
They say Irish women can be a strange blend of shyness, of pride and conceit, yet they have a stubborn refusal to bow in defeat. Their hate is as fierce as their devotion is grand, yet there is no middle ground on which they will stand. My family and friends tell me this sums me up exactly. I'm Carol Ann Gallagher. I am a proud Irish immigrant and now a partner at Dwyer & Coogan, a personal injury law firm here in Chicago. I was born and raised on a little island off the coast of Donegal. I studied and practiced law in Ireland before emigrating to Chicago 11 years ago, and I took up the practice of law here too. As a personal injury lawyer, I've been blessed to help those who find themselves in vulnerable and tragic circumstances. In my proud representation of families injured by the negligence of others, I've secured millions of dollars in verdicts and settlements for my clients. I can be your advocate. I can have your back. I will fight for you when you feel like you have no fight left within yourself. For more information, please go to my website at dwyercoogan.com or give me a call, Caroline Gallagher, at 312-543-4642. That's 312-543-4642. All of our consultations are free. Thanks for listening.
History going all the way back to 1896, the International Union of Operating Engineers has continued to protect workers and their families with loyalty and brotherhood. Local 150 has continued to thrive through economic booms and busts with careful training and aggressive organizing. Under the leadership of President and Business Manager Jim Sweeney, Local 150 has implemented programs and action plans to create work, protect benefits, and keep members working. And they've been helping the Irish-American community of Chicagoland for just as long. The Hibernian Radio Show is proud to be associated with Jim Sweeney and Local 150, and we salute the continuing efforts of the International Union of Operating Engineers and their support of Irish and Irish-American families now and in the future. Thanks to Local 150.
breakfast.
McCann's Irish Oatmeal. We've been warming the hearts, minds, and souls of the most discriminating oatmeal lovers for over 150 years. From the family farm to your table, enjoy the whole grain goodness of McCann's Irish Oatmeal today. Available at your local grocery store.
There's only one Irish pub in the Chicago River, and that's Lizzie McNeil's at 400 North McClure Court. We spent a lot of time there, taping the Hibernian radio show at Lizzie McNeil's every Wednesday night. You can escape the hustle and bustle of Navy Pier and relax at Lizzie McNeil's. Our old pal John Wren is your host. Please say hello when you stop by for one of their ice-cold brews in an authentic Irish pub. One visit and you'll be calling it your hometown hangout. We've been hanging at Lizzie's for going on 10 years now, so join us. When the weather gets nice, they have two outdoor patio areas where you can take advantage of the sunshine and a cafe menu of salads, sandwiches, and appetizers. Lizzie's also has a great private party room that's perfect for birthdays, graduations, and most nights at Lizzie's you can meet the elite of Chicago's Irish-American community. So stop by Lizzie McNeil soon, right by the river, and tell them you were sent by your old pal, Hooley. Thanks.
And we are back on Hibernian Radio, your old friend Mike Coulihan, WSBC, every Saturday night from 7 to 8. Thanks for joining us. We are here with the history detective, Rick Barrett, our old pal, and he is in the midst of telling us, after all that whole thing with the French Connection and in Paris and everything, came back, and you were still with the DEA, and you guys were investigating gang crime in Chicago, basically.
Exactly.
It was drug syndicate.
Yeah. And you know, in Chicago, we would call them corporate gangs because they resembled the structure of a legitimate corporation, like a pyramid. So we said we're going to take the big bats of the federal government, you know, the big laws like RICO and continuing criminal enterprise and the federal forfeiture statutes, and we're going to target the leaders. We had we adopted a little motto. So we're going to put the crosshairs on the kingpins.
Ah, that's good.
So we identified, you know, everyone knew who the kingpins were. It was common knowledge. And you know what? Larry had been, like we said earlier, in prison for 20 years, but he was...
He was running it from prison.
Yeah, because you know what? We knew who was running it on the street, and then we would surveil them, and they'd get in their car every Friday night and drive 350 miles to Vienna. That's how they pronounce it.
They pronounce it Vienna.
Yeah, they, down there, the southern...
Well, I was reading your Vienna thing today, and it said... Hey, I wouldn't drive 350 miles to see Miss America.
Every weekend? For years?
Years.
And years?
So
and
they,
years.
They developed a lot of loyalty.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And this evidently, Larry Hoover was a lot smarter than people gave him credit
for.
Oh,
he was brilliant. You know, he could have been.
He was like the CEO of this huge corporation.
Huge. At the time, I they were in over 30 states.
Wow.
Yeah.
You said in your talk that you said, at any moment, he could put 10,000 people on the street.
Oh, he did. He did. And
just like that, bang.
Just like that, bang. And I have a picture of it taken from the fifth floor of City Hall.
Yeah?
Yes. And it was a political organization that Larry founded called 21st Century Vote.
Oh, yeah.
V-O-T.
He kind of modeled himself after Mayor Richard J. Daley.
Yes, he admired him. He read about him when he was in prison. Yeah. And it was stood for Votes of Total Empowerment, V-O-T-E. But in any event...
It was all a front, though.
It was all a front for money laundering.
Yeah.
You know, people say they would contribute to the political organization, and really what they were doing is turn over proceeds to the GDs.
Money.
And by the way, he changed the name from Gangster Disciples to Growth and Development. Yeah. And he had a lot of political pull in Chicago. Former Mayor Sawyer was...
Oh, yeah. Eugene Sawyer.
He was way behind him.
Kidding. Oh, they were all trying to get him paroled.
Trying to get him paroled because he was going to come out and talk to these young...
You guys had to put a stop to that before he got...
Well, and I would listen to it on the radio while we were watching these guys on the street. I'm thinking, wow, we better get him because he's going to be out. He had all kinds of people.
He had a great story. And you guys are observing these guys at prison, and you got... Larry Hoover, and it's a minimum security.
Minimum
prison.
Security golf course right outside,
and he's out there with his girlfriend. And,
yeah,
all his buddies, and
exactly.
You said if we could find out what this guy is saying,
and
you guys came up with this incredible scheme, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, and that was strictly, you know,
with the badges.
Yeah, it was lucky. It was a lucky thing. It was, you know, you make the most of it. You know, you work hard and you get lucky, and boom. But here's what happened. One of my agents was over in the U.S. Attorney's Office on a different case. Yeah. And he didn't like what the U.S. attorney was saying to him. He was really upset and mad. He came over and he comes to my office red in the face, screaming and yelling about this prosecutor.
Venting
like crazy. And I noticed on his sport coat he had a visitor's tag attached.
From the prison?
Well, from the U.S. attorney's office,
okay.
Where he was.
Yeah.
So I, just to break the ice and settle him down, I said, "Hey, dude, do you realize that everything you're saying is being transmitted back to the U.S. attorney's office? They're listening to you right now." Talk behind their back. So we started laughing, and I was like, "Hey, wait a second.
That ain't a bad idea.
That ain't a bad idea.
Yeah.
Do you think we could?" And then just started, we drew schematics of what visitors pass might.
Well, you told me you went home and your little brother was like a computer nerd.
My son.
Oh, it was your son?
Yeah.
Tim.
Yeah, Tim. He was a computer nerd. I said, "Hey, get on that machine and draw me a visitor's pass."
Yeah.
So he found the great seal of the state of Illinois.
Yeah.
You know, and he made up this thing. It said, "Do not remove under penalties of law."
Yeah.
You know, kind of, so anyway, make a long story short, the visitors down there did not wear visitor's passes at all. They just signed in and they went into a lunchroom.
So you had to bring those in, basically.
So, yeah. Well, first of all, we had to sell the idea because people thought we were crazy.
Yeah.
And 50% of our office didn't understand we were targeting someone who was already incarcerated.
Oh, yeah. He's already in jail. Why do
Yeah. Half the office hated me. They go, "Hey, there goes the guy who's trying to lock up somebody who's been locked up for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, "You guys just don't get it, you know?"
Yeah.
And so we designed what we called a placebo, and it was a visitor's pass, but there was no
bug
in it. It was just a plastic visitor's pass because you had to introduce it to a prison population because anything you introduce.
So they get used to it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we had it in there for 6 months, and during those 6 months, we're doing surveillance on everyone who's leaving Chicago and blasting down there for the weekend, seeing Larry, having private conversations with him. And then, you know, you had free reign. He could sit anywhere he wanted in the lunchroom, just like where we are now. You could pick any table.
Yeah.
So how do you intercept a conversation when you have no idea where he's going to be? And he could walk outside.
You get it on the visitor badge.
So we're like, hey,
that's pretty smart.
So we had to get a federal court order.
Yeah.
From a, you know, U.S. District Court.
And you had to get some tech nerds who could build it and everything.
Just by luck, my boss sent me to a money laundering conference in Fort Lauderdale, and it was St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I'll never forget. It was St. Patrick's Day, and it was a huge train accident. You could see it on YouTube. And anyway, we went out. The class emptied out. We were helping people off the train, and we're walking back, and I noticed there's a place called Audio Intelligence Devices right there, like two blocks from where the train wreck was. So I just walked in cold.
Yeah.
I said, "Hey, I'd like to speak to one of your engineers about
an idea. Yeah.
So I get this German engineer. Yeah. He's listening to me, listening. He goes, "We can do that." I was like, "Oh my God." And I'm thinking, it's going to cost so much money.
Yeah.
I said, "Yeah, but, you know, come on. How much is it going to cost?" He goes, $1,500 a badge. I'll get you two of them for $3,000. I'm like, whoa, that's like an ounce and a half of Coke.
Yeah.
I can talk my bosses into that. I go back, you're never going to believe it.
Only had to bug the badges that you want. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Going to see Larry, here's your badge.
Yeah. Would you like to wear it around your neck or would you like to clip it on your shirt?
Yeah.
Your choice.
Yeah.
But one way or another, you're wearing the badge.
That's great.
Yeah. So we did that, and his boys would come in. His guys would come in, and they were all named in the court order. And the man that we had working with us was handpicked by the director of the Illinois prison system. He was called into the U.S. Attorney's Office and said, "We are going to do this operation, and the weakest link is the Illinois Department of Corrections."
Oh, yeah.
You got to pick a guard who you know is going to be 100% an honest, high degree of integrity, yada, yada, yada. And if he gives it up, we're going to hold you responsible.
Oh, wow.
So he picked a great guy. And we had the thing made. We got the court order. And 6 months went by with the placebos, and now we're ready to go live.
So you got it all. They're used to it by then.
Yep, they're all used to it.
Wow.
And it was Halloween weekend. I know it was October 30th or 31st that weekend. And the very first, you know, few minutes of intercepted conversation, they're talking about exactly what you think they talk about.
Yeah.
Murders, dope, You know,
and you got it all on
and
tape.
We're like, oh my God, this is working, because we had receivers in the ceiling.
Yeah.
And they were tied into long distance AT&T hard wires.
Oh, yeah.
So we had it. The signal was a wireless signal that went up to this receiver. The receiver took it, converted it to over long distance lines, and brought it right into the federal building, 350 miles away up
wow.
here in Chicago. And we're listening.
They're listening?
We're listening live.
Wow.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
So anyway, he only had, we were only authorized to do it on weekends.
Yeah, and you got
Saturday
4 hours, you said, of complete conversation. That was enough, though, right?
Well, we got, actually, we got like 5 weekends, and I don't know, I think it was a little over 30 hours of tapes.
Oh, wow.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But they were very, very hard to transcribe.
Yeah.
You know, they use an amalgam of street
jargon.
Talk, jargon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of that Mississippi drawl, some prison talk.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of the stuff. We
so
had,
you needed Gator Bradley to translate.
Well, we're, you know, Gator Bradley's the luckiest man on the planet.
Yeah.
He used to visit Larry during the week.
He was the urban translator.
He was the urban translator. Yeah, and he's, you know, he would hate me if he ever met me, for sure. Yeah.
Well, so, now I want to, now this is fascinating. And
yeah.
Good for you. But we don't only have so much time. I want to get into
yeah.
your campaign about the Chicago
The
first policeman killed in the line
yeah.
of duty
oh, boy.
Was an Irishman, Constable yeah. James Quinn. Is that
yes, it? Yes, yes, yes.
Tell us about that.
Oh, I just...
Because you're a great investigator.
Well...
I know, because you're yeah. working on a film with me right
yeah,
now, investigating.
That's
you're
true.
Just like a dog, man. Yeah. It's like, I'm
going to find this.
Yeah. So you wanted to find out, they were claiming somebody else.
Well, actually what it was I just was interested in my family roots in the Chicago Police Department. And I didn't know where we were from in Ireland. I thought we were from County Mayo.
Yeah.
So, you know, I start, one thing leads to another, and I go, oh, my God, we're from County Cork. You know, imagine that. So I kept digging and digging and digging. And then I found that the original records of the Chicago City Council prior to the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, they were still around. They were found 110 years later in 1981
yeah.
in a warehouse in wooden boxes with pigeons nesting in them. Everyone thought they'd burned up in the fire. And here they were 110 years later.
The Great Chicago Fire?
The Great Chicago Fire.
Oh, yeah.
Because the City Hall was destroyed.
Oh, yeah.
And with it, they thought the records of the city were destroyed.
Yeah.
So happened the records weren't there. They were at another location outside the fire zone.
That's great.
Survived the fire. They surfaced in 1981. Imagine that, 110
wow.
years later. Well, they were indexed and they were cataloged and so on and so forth. And during my research, I thought, well, the original records of the city council from 1837
yeah.
to 1871 are here.
Yeah, here.
Let's
Chicago.
Look at them.
Yeah.
So I looked at them and I went through anything to do with the police.
Yeah.
I would read, and I came across a petition of a Margaret Quinn for compensation.
Constable Quinn's widow.
Yeah. Widow, yeah, for compensation for her husband's line of duty death in 1853. And I was like, whoa, I got to get a hold of that affidavit that she filed.
Yeah.
So I wrote to the archives. 3 weeks later, it arrives, and there's the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, that she made this claim, and the claim was reviewed by the Judiciary Committee of the city, which was comprised of 3 lawyers, 2 of whom were from the Know Nothing Party.
Oh.
Yet they still...
Those dirty blackguards.
Yes, but they still... That's interesting that they still... decided in favor of the constable that he, in fact, died in the line of
duty.
Yeah, because you know what? I mean, then I found all kinds of records. It was just proof beyond, way beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean,
and
it's
so
a long story,
it was actually an Irish police officer who was the first one
yeah,
to die
yeah.
in the line of duty
yeah.
for the city of Chicago.
He was from County Kilkenny.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know what? Goofy me. I'm naive as heck. I thought I was, you know, a good shepherd and found a lost sheep.
Yeah.
So I called... Actually, what I did was send an email, and I addressed it to 3 aldermen and the superintendent's honored staircase, whoever runs that, right?
Yeah.
So I get a
brick wall.
Oh, my God. I mean, well, when we went over, Skinny went with me the first time I ever presented the evidence.
At the city council?
Actually, we went to the police department first.
Okay.
And dealt with their historian, who said, quote, "This is nothing but a can of worms for me."
Oh, yeah. He didn't want to deal with it.
He didn't want to deal with it because he was tied to the guy who, they, 9 months after the constable, they had just celebrated him as being the first officer.
Yeah, it was his name? Laflong or something like that?
Lauer. Casper Lauer, who, by the way, was born in France.
But not a French, not an Irishman.
No, he was. Yeah. They always claimed he was born in Germany, No, he was not born in Germany. I have his birth certificate.
Yeah.
I have his father's birth certificate, and I have his grandfather's. Six generations of them were born in France. Now, I have to tell you this. It was a disputed area. Went back and forth every century between France and Germany, But when they were born and when they lived there, it belonged to France. So, make no mistake.
He wasn't an Irishman, as simple as that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but it went on, Huli, as you know, it went on
for years.
Yeah. 14 years.
As a matter of fact, I seem to recall writing a story about this for the Irish American News.
You were the first
journalist to cover it.
You were the first journalist to ever write about this.
Yeah.
Think about how long ago that was.
Yeah.
Because I discovered it in 2002.
Yeah.
And I think you wrote in 2003.
Yeah. I can't remember when it was, but yeah.
Yeah, it was 2003 because we had just got turned down by the police department.
Nobody else would write about it and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. I was pulling my hair out. I mean, look, here's evidence.
It's gone.
It's gone. Be gone. But, yeah, and then, you know what? Oh, what an incredible story this is. My brother calls me one day in 2006.
Yeah.
Now we're into it 3 years.
You're starting, still fighting the good fight.
Just getting warmed up.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, do you get Chicago Magazine? I go, no, why? He goes, because there's an article on the cover this month on whatever happened to Chicago's famous families. And he goes, didn't you tell me that Potter Palmer was one of the jurors, one of the 12 jurors?
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, that he sat in the trial. He was a juror in the trial of the guy who killed the constable, a guy named William Reese.
Yeah.
And how do I know that? Because the newspapers of the day, they printed the names of the jurors.
Sure.
And I went and had all the old newspapers from the
1850s. And years later, we had drinks with his grandson
so
at
that
the Palmer House.
That was the deal.
Yeah, after the parade.
So that's how that all developed.
Yeah.
I called one day and it was like, gave the number. It didn't say, hello, this is Potter Palmer. It just said, this is 847, blah, 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 blah. Leave a message.
Yeah.
So I left a message and I said, hey, please don't hang up. I'm not a kook. I'm not looking for any money.
Well, wait a minute.
I should have said, wait a minute. I am a kook. I'm investigating an 1853 murder.
Yeah.
This is legit. Please call me back because your great grandfather was one of the jurors. Well, I never heard from him. And I thought, oh, God. Well, I shouldn't say never. About 5 days later, my phone in my office rings, and I pick it up. Hello. He goes, hello, Mr. Barrett. I go, yeah. He goes, this is Potter Palmer returning your call.
Yeah.
I go, what? What? He goes, well, you called me, didn't you? I go, yeah, I did. I can't believe it. This is great. Listen. And then, boom. Told him the story. And the reason I wanted to contact him, because I was hoping, fingers crossed, couple of novenas, that maybe his famous great-grandfather had a manuscript or a diary or some papers that were passed down through the family, and maybe he wrote about his service as a juror.
Yeah.
Could you imagine that?
Yeah.
Well,
but he went to bat for you.
Yeah, so he goes, no, I'm sorry to tell you that, no, we don't have anything like that. And then he goes to tell me that, well, we did used to have 6 original French Impressionist paintings, but my grandmother gave them all to the art museum in Chicago.
Chicago Art Institute. They're worth gazillions.
They're worth gazillions, and grandma gave them all away. So that was pretty. And Potter turned out to be the nicest guy in the world.
He's a nice guy.
He's a super guy. He's not pretentious.
Yeah.
He loves police. He was just
a fascinating
guy. You know
what? You got to come back and tell this story because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
Here.
Well, it went on and on and on.
And then I also want to hear the whole story about the first woman police
officer. Another Irish gal.
Yes.
Yes.
But we got a break now because you're on fire, man. Come back in about 3 weeks.
These are all long stories. I apologize.
No, that's all right. It's terrific. Listen, thanks so much.
Okay.
We're going to take a break on the Hibernian Radio Show. We'll be right back after these messages from our friends.
They say Irish women can be a strange blend of shyness, of pride and conceit, yet they have a stubborn refusal to bow in defeat. Their hate is as fierce as their devotion is grand, yet there is no middle ground on which they will stand. My family and friends tell me this sums me up exactly. I'm Caroline Gallagher. I am a proud Irish immigrant and now a partner at Dwyer & Coogan, a personal injury law firm here in Chicago. I was born and raised on a little island off the coast of Donegal. I studied and practiced law in Ireland before emigrating to Chicago 11 years ago, and I took up the practice of law here too. As a personal injury lawyer, I've been blessed to help those who find themselves in vulnerable and tragic circumstances. In my proud representation of families injured by the negligence of others, I've secured millions of dollars in verdicts and settlements for my clients. I can be your advocate. I can have your back. I will fight for you when you feel like you have no fight left within yourself. For more information, please go to my website at dwyercoogan.com or give me a call, Caroline Gallagher, at 312-543-4642. That's 312-543-4642. All of our consultations are free. Thanks for listening.
McCann's Irish Oatmeal. We've been warming the hearts, minds, and souls of the most discriminating oatmeal lovers for over 150 years. From the family farm to your table, enjoy the whole grain goodness of McCann's Irish Oatmeal today, available at your local grocery store.
When your family has suffered a loss, there's one family I know who will be there for you. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes are third-generation, family-owned and operated. The Sheehy family has dedicated their lives serving families throughout Chicago and the southwest suburbs. The Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Home was incorporated in 1913 as a storefront at 76th and Halsted in Chicago. At the time, this was one of the few standalone funeral homes of its kind and was to be the first of many to come bearing the Sheehy name. The founder, Roger Sheehy Sr., was soon joined in business by his three sons, Roger Jr., Jack, and Bob. This trademark of service is evident 98 years later, as Bob and Jim Sheehy, third generation, own and operate two locations in Orland Park and Burbank. At Sheehy's, the name on their sign outside the funeral home means something. For them, it's very important that everyone be treated as if they were family, friend, or neighbor, as they very well could be. When my brother Willie died a few years ago, the Sheehys took very good care of our family. And you know, you never forget something like that. Their entire staff cares about each and every family they serve. Every detail is handled in a professional and personal manner. On a daily basis, the directors Bill Kiley, Mike LaRocque, and John Sullivan, and the rest of the staff take great pride in their work, serving families as if they were their own. Bob Sheehy will tell you, we pride ourselves on offering the highest level of professionalism with every family we serve. Robert J. Sheehy & Sons Funeral Homes, here for you since 1913.
This is Mike Houlihan. I support Concern Worldwide. If you want to do something about global poverty, hunger, refugees, the unacceptable suffering of young children, if you want to reach people directly where the need is greatest, you should too. For 50 years, since its grassroots beginnings in Dublin, Concern has saved and changed millions of lives. It's been the proud, relentlessly compassionate face of Ireland to the world. Support Concern today at ConcernUSA.org. That's ConcernUSA.org. There is no more Irish thing you can do. If you're looking for an office in the loop, you gotta check out Integrated Office Suites at 20 North Clark Street and 455 North City Front Plaza Drive in the NBC Tower. IOS has an entire floor in these two very prestigious buildings, and they offer the best in executive offices, virtual business offices, personalized phone answering, conference room and day office usage, administrative support services, and customized packages with fixed monthly invoices. Integrated Office Suites are convenient and very classy. So get in touch with our friends at integratedofficesuites.com or call them at 312-561-2300 and tell them Skinny and Hooley sent you. That's integratedofficesuites.com, 312-561-2300. You'll be glad you did.
There's no friend like an old friend. Southside Cousins Mike and Dick Haggerty have been selling cars for over 45 years. They've been in business together since 1982, when they started their first store, where everybody in the old neighborhood bought their cars. I go way back with the Haggertys. Mike's a Mount Carmel alum and Dick is St. Ignatius. Dick and Mike have been particularly classy to me over the years. Whenever I visit their showroom, it's old school. Buick GMC at 9301 South Cicero, or the Volkswagen store at 89th and Cicero, both in Oak Lawn. So do yourself a favor. Get to know the Haggerty family. You'll be delighted you did. I'm currently driving a used car I bought at Haggerty's. It's a gem. And when I think I got lucky, I have to tell myself, no, it's because Haggerty took good care of me. God bless him. Call him today at 708-423-5000. 708-423-5000, or go to HaggertyCars.com. Generations of Southside Irish have been happily driving Haggerty cars for generations. Visit Mike Haggerty Buick and GMC at 93rd and Cicero, and Mike Haggerty Volkswagen at 89th and Cicero. And tell them Hooley sent you. And if you're a first responder, you just might get a better deal than I did. And we're back on Hibernian Radio. Oh, man, that Ricky Barrett is dynamite, isn't he? He's going to be back. He'll tell us the whole story of Constable Quinn and the first female police officer, who is also Irish, by the way. But we got to get, you know, as I've said many times before, Billy, you know, whenever I'm walking down Western Avenue and I look in the window, Ken's or Wrong's or Hart's or any of those great saloons, and I see the ghost of my old pal Jimmy Goff through the mist, and he says to me, "Hey, holy, who dang?" Joan Johanna McNicholas, beloved wife of the late Michael McNicholas from Charleston, County Mayo. She's the loving mother of Mary Kay, Michael, John, Dan, and Timothy McNicholas. She's the adored daughter of the late John Farrader from Dingle, County Kerry, and the late Catherine Doohan from County Donegal. Sounds like a wonder. Say a prayer for her. She was waked at Sheehy's, of course, where all the right people go. Say a prayer for Johanna McNicholas. Also, Lois Fitzmaurice, beloved wife of 44 years of the late James C. Fitzmaurice, loving mother of James, Michael, and Patrick, friend of many, fond aunt of many nieces and nephews, in lieu of flowers, donation to the Mulliganeers, which is a great organization, and their thing is coming up in March. We'll be plugging them some more. But funnily enough, one of the members of the Mulliganeers is our old pal Bob Sheehy, and that's where Lois Fitzmaurice was waked, at Sheehy's, where all the right people go. All right, thanks to our pal P.J. O'Day for giving us those two obits. We're going to close up the crypt, Billy. And I want to remind everybody, hey, drop in to see our friends Mike Courtney and his wife Dawn at the Twisted Shamrock Irish Pub, 6462 South Central in Chicago. It's one of the best Irish pubs in the Midway area, and Mike and Dawn will take good care of yous. Or if you're headed over to Western Avenue tonight or any time this weekend, stop in and say hello to our friends Mary and Bernard at Barney Callahan's Irish Pub, 10618 Southwestern. It's the perfect Southside Irish bar, and there's always something going on there, and tell them Hooley sent you. And the Irish American News has been bringing you the news important to the Irish in Chicagoland for 40 years. Like mostly good news and information from all facets of the Irish community, check out the Irish American News. To advertise or subscribe, call our pal Cliff Carlson at 847-872-0700 or email him cliff@irishamericannews.com. And that's where the first story appeared about Constable Quinn. Hey, you know, the bagpipes and drums of the Emerald Society, Chicago Police Department Band, are having a recruitment drive. You can become part of the tradition and join today. There's only two requirements to join. You have to be active or retired member of law enforcement dedicated to honoring the fallen. You can email our representatives at any time, and they will get glad to answer your questions. The recruitment drive is February 13th, 2020, at 1900. What's that, 7 o'clock? Chicago Police Academy, 1300 West Jackson Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois. Get in touch with the band manager, Deputy Chief Clint Wagner from the Flossmoor Police Department, Emerald Society Band, ES Band Manager at gmail.com. Or Pipe Major John Harmoning, Chicago Police Department. Hey, we're going to have him on the show one of these days. The band manager's telephone call or text at 773-410-9779. Or go to www.copsinkilts.com. Those are our friends at the Emerald Society. Actually, they got a lot of stuff coming up because, of course, St. Patrick's Day is right around the corner. So get hip to that. They're having a
March with the band on Parade Day, Saturday, March 14th. Also a big post-parade party over at Local 399 headquarters. The Wild Colonial Boys Celtic Band, one of the nation's best Celtic bands, will be providing music for the gala. And I'll play you some music of theirs next week. Also, they're having a night at the Wolves game, Emerald Society of Illinois. You can't say enough about the Emerald Society. It's just a great organization, and we thank them for all the help that they've given us with this show over the last year and a half almost. Okay, now take a little trip to Hooleytown just for some who cares. Let's take, one more plug, Jim Mullen's applesauce. Don't forget Jim Mullen, police officer seriously injured in the line of duty years ago, and now he sells applesauce. It's like apple pie without the crust. Mullen's applesauce, you can't beat it. And it's great stuff. So if you see that on the shelf at Jewel, pick it up. Okay. Now, Billy, we're going to take a quick little trip to Hooleytown.
Deep, deep in deep, the south deep. Side of Chicago.
Get me out of here.
So deep, deep. All deep. The way up to 93rd Street.
Get me out of here, please.
Across the tracks where they only spoke Yaki Dak.
Oh.
And the people barely survived on a strict diet of crunchy bouncer and bamboo.
Hey, man, you want another drink?
Yes.
Can I get you two?
This yeah. is almost 70 years we're talking.
70
when
years?
The mix still what? Hit on his teeth.
Oh.
Something entered his cranium.
His cranium?
And wormed around his frontal lobes and took him to a state of mind.
Mind.
Hidden place on the other side of bunkers.
Welcome.
Crazy, silly, screwy.
Have a seat.
Known as... Hooleytown.
Hooleytown.
Welcome to Hooleytown. Don't stay too long, though.
How come?
Because you might not come back. Welcome to Hooleytown.
Why, thank you.
And you're welcome.
Yeah, welcome to Hooleytown. And as I like to say whenever I'm in Hooleytown, Billy, would you please give me a hand? Teresa Guiducci explains why she had her breasts redone 10 years after first augmentation.
Who cares?
Brad Pitt hilariously wore a name tag to the Oscars luncheon.
Who cares?
Jessica Biel orders Justin Timberlake to therapy.
Who cares?
J-Lo and Shakira will give separate Super Bowl shows. I'll be watching
for
that.
Who cares?
Hey, Ben Affleck and Jen Garner had a street fight.
Who cares?
Heather Locklear caught popping pills.
Who cares?
Julia Roberts is still trashing her dead sister.
Who cares?
Jeffrey Epstein to be exhumed.
Who cares?
And finally, scientists confirm Kardashians not human.
Who cares?
Buzz it up. Oh, Billy, give me a hand. Get up on my shoulder. Grab the latch at the top. Can you get the latch? Get it. Oh, perfect. Thanks. Time for one joke? One joke. One joke only. All right, so this is an interesting story. A man goes to the doctor, twitching his fingers and stuttering, finally manages to say, "Doctor, I have a sexual performance problem. Can you help me?" "Well, that's not a problem for us men anymore," says the doctor. "They just came out with this new wonder drug that does the trick. You take the pill, and your problems are history." The doctor gives the man a prescription and sends him on his merry way. A couple of days later, the doctor runs into this guy on the street. "Doctor, doctor," yells the man excitedly. "I got to thank you. This drug is a miracle. It's wonderful. I had sex 14 times in 8 days. "Well, I'm glad to hear that," says the pleased doctor. "What does your wife think about it?" "Wife? I haven't even been home yet." Okay. One more. Okay. Three nuns were talking. The first nun said, "I was cleaning Monsignor's room the other day, and do you know what I found? A bunch of pornographic magazines." "What did you do?" the other nuns asked. "Well, of course, I threw them all in the trash." The second nun said, "Well, I can top that. I was in the Monsignor's room putting away the laundry, and I found a bunch of condoms." "Oh, my God," asked Augusta, the other nuns. "What did you do?" they asked. "Well, at first I wanted to trash them too, but after giving it a little thought, I poked holes in all of them." The third nun fainted. And that's all. Well, thanks for joining us, folks. We'll get Ricky Barrett back on the show again. Next week, we got our old friend Carol Ann Gallagher on the show. Tune in for that. She's always got great stories. And thanks so much for listening, and God bless you all.